Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the marketing and advertising podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Runicus.
Hi, and I'm Paul Jacobs. Welcome to today's show. And today's guest is Jeremy King, founder and CEO of Attest. And today we're talking about probably one of the world's biggest acronyms, DTC. We're going to be delving into Jeremy's vast insight database and focusing on the direct-to-consumer sector. Jeremy has kindly agreed to share the results of some brand new research, which is very exciting. It's called the DTC Digest, which we'll dive into very shortly, which helps us understand how DTC brands are likely to fare as the high street returns to normal. So welcome, Jeremy. Thank you very much for joining us on Wax Lyrical.
Delighted to be here and excited to talk.
Great stuff. So first off, I think kind of the obvious place to start is to learn a bit more about Attest. Kind of the formal background we've got describes Attest as a consumer research platform, but kind of tell us what you do and how you support marketers.
Yeah, we're a technology company based in London and New York, and we exist to inform any intuition and dissolve every doubt. What does that mean? Businesses all over the world are constantly having to guess what their target market wants, what consumers want, why they make choices, how they choose competitors, what the latest trends are. And we believe that you shouldn't have to guess. You can ask your target consumers what they want, why they make their choices, and that should be as easy as sending an email. So we put that in a technology platform that lets anyone in any business do this type of consumer research, show things to people, ask them to questions, anywhere in the world about anything, and that helps you make better business decisions. And deep down, that helps you drive growth. We like to call it growth without guesswork, and that's quite fun to do.
And we'll definitely get into some of your kind of clients and case studies later in the pod. But I mean, a big inspiration for this was kind of what's going to happen to this sector post-COVID. Mark and I are both big fans of the sector, as you know, and fortunate enough to work with several as part of our kind of day-to-day clients. You've done some specific research, as we touched on, the kind of D2C digest. Kind of what is within that that we can say to kind of that is reason to be optimistic about what's to come post-pandemic?
Yeah, a lot of optimism in there. And we did some work comparing US versus UK numbers just to have some interesting counterpoints, and because those are two very interesting markets. So probably three things to start with. One, there's a lot to be optimistic about for D2C. So particularly millennials are really committed to online shopping and have a lower propensity to return to the real world. Shops in the UK and the US are opening again now, and we're seeing about a 15% net reduction in people aged 18 to 40 shopping online. That conversion from online back into the real world is going to happen, but probably far less than we saw 12 months, 18 months ago. That's quite different across different age groups. So UK millennials, they're reducing by 13%, Gen Z 16%, and then women lead the way as the return to the high street at a 20% reduction in their online shopping. So it's going to be women, and particularly older women in that 18 to 40 range, that will drive the return to the high street. Everyone else, it seems to be quite a permanent shift, but there's a big commitment to online shopping, and that type of D2C movement is here to stay. Second thing, openness about trying new brands, particularly those that are D2C, is very, very high, and that seems set to stay. So in the UK, 72% of consumers aged 18 to 40 agree that they are prepared to try new brands online and that they are already doing that. 84% say they're open to trying new brands specifically through D2C channels. In the US, that's 75% of US millennials and 71% of Gen Z who are already trying shopping with their favorite brands online in D2C, and 90% of millennials are open to trying new brands through D2C channels. That's quite exciting too. I think the third thing that we'll see is there's been a huge amount of volatility, lockdowns opening, closing high streets, people moving into and away from Netflix. We saw a couple of weeks back Netflix share price take a huge tank as people cut the cord on Netflix itself. Like, that volatility is going to continue. But the underlying trend is hugely in favor of D2C. Things that you can personalize through D2C, values that you can play to through D2C, new products you can take to market in D2C as a channel that now has far greater propensity to succeed than ever before. So put these three things together. Online shopping and D2C habits are here to stay. There will be a return to the real world, but smaller and slower than many are projecting. Openness to try new D2C is higher than ever, particularly with younger people. And then third is the underlying drivers of this D2C movement that we've seen over the last 12, 18 months. A lot of those are here to stay. And I think wrap that all together, very positive picture for D2C looking ahead.
Are there some basics that mean here in the 21st century, the D2C model is really working? If so, what are they?
I think probably in my mind, there's four, and we see them a lot in all the data that we see, but also from a lot of our clients. So one, simplicity is the new luxury. Thing that you really want is now right there for the taking and very accessible to you. It can come to you and you can buy it online. You don't have to pick from a defined range in a shop. You don't have to let a buyer in a large department store make that choice on your behalf. These range of choices can not only come to your door, but are far more available to you. Second, you can take control of the experience. So delivery times, return options, rewards you're using, referral codes and discounts. And over and above that, a match with your personal values. We've seen a huge amount of D2C companies go for sustainable packaging, plant-based foods, donations to different charitable causes. And this is a great way to acquire consumers who want that simplicity and who want that choice. But there's lots of different ingredients baked into the D2C model that allow you to customize it to your consumers far more than any real world or high street retailers can even dream of. Third, perfect for virality. So when you find a product that you love, it's likely that people you know are going to love it for the same reasons, because it has those personal values. It hits those right rewards and discount factors, those delivery return preferences, and that simplicity. And the D2C model is brilliant at getting referrals between networks. And I think that can happen faster than ever. We see great channels for that, all the classic marketing channels, but it's that user get user and network get network. That model is really available to D2C, and that's a huge advantage for D2C players. I think D2C players should play into that a lot more. And then four, there's many different ways to construct a D2C company. You have to worry about supply chain. You have to worry about branding and marketing. As you said, data analytics can be a great growth driver, or you can completely ignore it and just go for brilliant product and brilliant brand promises. Huge amounts of extras you can throw in. We've seen a whole bunch of D2C players in the UK throw in affiliate marketing, flyers and offers in their delivery boxes, different tech stacks that exist just to serve D2C. There's all these ways you can construct a D2C company, and that just fuels this level of simplicity, the level of customization, and the viral effect. Put all this together, now is probably the best time ever to build a D2C company, and that's why we see a lot of big companies getting into D2C, but also the genesis of so many interesting new D2C models.
And at the risk of sounding contradictory, I'm going to be honest and say I come from a very small line of tiny shopkeepers, not a retail dynasty, but I had uncles and in one mining town in Nottinghamshire. So I'm a big fan of the high street. And I actually think this is great. I think this will stimulate the main high street retailers to fight back. And a few weeks ago, just after retail opened, you saw the ridiculous queues outside Primark at 5 a.m. And they were already announcing that they're back to profit in some spectacular way. Well, almost back to profit. So it does look like the high street will come back. The high street will fight back. And I remember talking about things like festival retailing and retailtainment and all those kind of words. So let's imagine all that does happen. So how can the D2C brands compete with all of that amazing physicality, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, people have been declaring the death of retail bank branches for over 40 years now, but yet we still have them. They're thriving, and their purpose has just hugely shifted. They serve different demographics, different purposes than they did 10, 20, 30 years ago. Same thing applies to the high street as we look ahead to the next 1, 5, 10, 50 years. I think exactly to your point, the purpose of the high street will change. What it does will change. It's job to be done for the consumer. Retailtainment, the experience of touching the products and seeing them. I think the best high street retailers will be the ones that jump on that fastest. But D2C is going to make it a different basis of competition and dynamic. And I think that's a healthy thing for the high street. As an evolutionary biologist, I believe in this natural selection. And I think some retailers will get selected out. We've seen it already. Many will survive and thrive and take over big ecosystems. A lot of opportunity there for the high street, therefore. I think let's pick out a couple of brands on your question about, you know, as the high street is reopening, who will survive and thrive? And I think let's pick out two examples. Bloom and Wild and Gymshark. So Bloom and Wild, a brilliant thing that they did over Valentine's Day a couple of months back now, they completely banned selling red roses, the most counterintuitive decision that you can imagine at Valentine's Day, synonymous with Valentine's Day itself. But Bloom and Wild stands for making each occasion and each gift and each delivery of flowers as special as it can be. And what they worked out is they had this intuition that red roses weren't that good anymore. No one really liked receiving them. Nobody really liked giving them. They were a last minute or default choice, kind of a lazy choice. In our research, we saw that women see it that way. People who receive red roses know that it's a last minute choice. They know it's a lazy choice. They know it's expensive and it's probably overpriced, and it's, you know, the impact is horribly diminished because of the circumstances that came to the choice of red roses. Men admit that it is actually a last minute choice. It's the default option. And like, wow, I've got one day left to buy something. I'll go red roses again. 10 years in a row now. Well done, me. Bloom and Wild decided to ban red roses completely. They had the intuition that it was wrong. They then used data from a test to make this very bold choice and go all in, not just to reduce, not just to de-emphasize, but to ban completely. And this got them a 4x year-on-year uplift in Valentine's Day sales and a 51% increase in share of voice across all media channels. Very, very counterintuitive move, informed by data, and they had the confidence to dissolve the doubt and inform the intuition using data from a test to actually make this bold move and look at the results. 4x year on year, amazing. And I think that's the type of thing, data-driven decision-making, very bold moves using their assets, which are fast supply chain, ability to run marketing campaigns in unique ways, and then take these bold and risky moves that someone like Interflora could never even consider. That gets you 4x year-on-year growth. And that's the advantage that D2C has. On the flip side, people like Gymshark, they're out there trying to figure out, what do we do in these volatile changing conditions? People were sent home from gyms. Suddenly, workout from home is now a theme. Gymshark could have seen this huge drop-off in revenue as the need to wear cool stuff in a gym and to show your brilliant Gymshark choices in a gym dissolved overnight. And they could see that this pending doom was coming. So what they did was they worked out, what do people want in their workout from home setups? As we get back into the gym, what are the new trends to act upon? They built whole sets of new influencer marketing campaigns and social content around this. And again, they used data from a test to inform exactly what they're going to do. In particular, they launched Gymshark Dailies. It was this email covering topics like workout routines, nutrition ideas, mental and well-being activities, which helped their customers through lockdown. But for Gymshark, this was a completely new form of engagement. It brought Gymshark much closer to those consumers and made the D of their D2C far more direct. Again, this is a lovely move where they use this potential weakness to turn it into an opportunity to get close to consumers. And now far more people know about Gymshark, trust Gymshark every day, both at home and now in the gym too. Super, super exciting. But it's those types of moves that let D2C players move fast on opportunities and take bold steps and go with the risky option that gives them advantages that others don't have. And that's quite exciting for D2C.
Yeah, I love the Bloom and Wild case study. That's and the thoughtful marketing movement they've created as well, which is it's a topic in itself. And I'm pretty sure we'll come back to that on the podcast soon enough. But so, I mean, Jeremy, we're all guilty of it, talking about kind of success stories. And I think with, as Mark's touched on, High Street's going to reopen and we're going to move back to, and I mean, doing some inverted commas, some omni-channel effectively. So that other channels and verticals are opening back up for brands. So those pure play D2Cs, like, I think we've touched on winners, but can we kind of think who might be the losers in this scenario and what can we learn from that?
Yeah, we've seen a few interesting things in the data. So we've seen things in the UK, clothing and accessories, electronics, big winners, and that's likely to stay. We've seen D2C lose out, particularly in food and beverage in the UK. And in the US, we've seen sports, hobbies, electronics in the win as the winners. And again, food and beverage as the losers. I think this is more about a weakness of D2C in that it's very, very hard when you have a D2C supply chain supporting your product. You can have arriving in your website 20 times more traffic than you've ever seen before. And that can happen in the first lockdown, US or UK, and everyone suddenly wants your food and beverage D2C product. but you can't manufacture it that fast. You can't ship it that fast. You have long lead times. You have bullwhip through your supply chain, and you just can't survive it. The very strength of D2C is that you can create all this virality, suddenly works against you, and you've disappointed 20 times more customers than you've ever seen before. That is a huge weakness. I think we also saw huge shifts in how consumers want to consume food and beverage. We've seen big winners, BrewDog getting into subscription boxes, Dry Soda in the US doing a similar D2C move. But what's interesting is that subscriptions in particular are predisposed to growth. And I think this is how food and beverage companies can D2C their way out of this relative loser status. So we saw in the US, 40% of US millennials and 29% of Gen Z are open to the idea of trying a new product subscription, specifically a type of monthly lock-in type thing. Here is how D2C in food and beverage can win their way out. The number in the UK was 31%, so slightly in between in the UK. Put that all together, there's a lot of winners in D2C, but the losers have to change their formula, particularly on supply chain and particularly on their business and revenue model, to D2C their way out of the challenges that come through this lockdown volatility.
Yeah, we've touched on it a few times. I think in terms of attitudinally, one of the big phenomenons is the kind of willingness of consumers to try out new brands online. I can speak from personal experience. Yeah, experimented way more kind of from, I guess, a slightly more kind of being at home way more. But do you think that will continue? I guess now we're kind of back out and about in the pubs, you know, do you think that continue? And if so, kind of what would you say to D2C brands about how they continue to be trialed? And then Mark and I often laugh about this, kind of these very modern brands but actually need very traditional practices, kind of promotions and things like that to make sure they remain trialed.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy when you look at the D2C landscape to get very excited about specific trends and say, we should all build a organic noodle company that sends sustainable packaging through your letterbox, and that's the next big thing. Deep down, we need to bring it back to the original themes of marketing, the four Ps. It is that simple, but consumers hold all the answers. So we went out and we found out what are the biggest drivers of discovery and purchase for D2C in the US versus the UK. So let's look at US first. The biggest drivers for discovery in the US are one, recommendation from a friend, two, social ads and ranking. But for older people, Gen Z and boomers, it's far more about recommendation and hearing from a brand and search results. So here we have that network thing coming into play. And these are the assets that D2C companies are built around. The top three purchase drivers in the US are fast and free delivery, discounts on first orders, and a really great quality website. Those are the things that cause D2C propositions to stand out to US consumers. For Gen Z and boomers older, it's discount, delivery, and website. So slightly different order on that, but it's these same factors in the US market that lead D2C brands to succeed. And to your point, it's the simple things. Do the simple things well, but particularly fast and free delivery is really, really important. Really easy to try to squeeze some margin out of that if you're a D2C player. Really easy to screw it up by choosing the wrong partners or distributors and to fail to make those supply chain links that consumers rely on and to leave unfulfilled promises. That's the number one driver of discovery and purchase. It's also the easiest thing to screw up. In the UK, it's quite different. So discovery drivers, recommendation from a friend, social ads, and then purchase drivers, again, fast and free delivery, website, and then discounting on first orders. This is how you acquire users and get them into the top of the funnel. Put that all together. It is those simple things. It is doing the simple things well. But we've got to take it back to the beginning, what we said about authenticity, links to values, simplicity is the new luxury, and playing into the virality and network effects that D2C can create. Put that all together. Great time to be alive for D2C companies.
So how can D2C brands generally find new customers post-COVID, Jeremy?
We've talked about all the classic tactics, all of the marketing things, but there's one thing that really stood out in our D2C Digest research that is counterintuitive. Huge favoritism for marketplaces. Marketplaces to discover new brands, new D2C propositions, and new bases of competition for D2C. So in the UK, 71% of consumers said that marketplaces help them to discover new brands, and 53% said they're more likely to try a new brand that they discovered on a marketplace than try it directly through the brand's own website. 53% prefer marketplace over the most direct D2C. That's an amazing result. For some reason, marketplaces, particularly for younger consumers, have emerged as a trusted source of discovery for D2C brands, new brands, and new options and choices. Marketplaces beyond that in the US are the primary place for Americans to discover online shopping journeys, especially millennials. Overall, 69% of respondents said that marketplaces help them discover new brands. That's 80% for millennials. And 53% again said they are more likely to try a new brand on a marketplace than going directly. And that's 64% for millennials. And what's interesting, we've seen this move kind of emerged over the last decade. A few classmates of mine from business school started Birchbox. It was the way that you discover new beauty products through samples delivered to you monthly. Some of that founding teams, particularly Amanda Tolleson, have gone on to found Maisonette, which is a marketplace for brands to market their new baby and child wear products. Maisonette is simply a venue where that all happens, and loads of different brands, D2C companies and propositions pop up in Maisonette, but Maisonette is the destination. This is kind of the online high street forming. It's a place where you do get ranging, but a far greater array of ranging. You can search that ranging, whereas in a physical store, you have to walk around and touch things. So it allows Maisonette and other marketplaces to have far greater range, far greater searchability, far greater choice, but with none of the implications of the inventory management, all the stock keepings, leakage, slippage, all of that. And I think it's marketplaces that are this very counterintuitive driver and source of growth. We all love to visit websites of D2C companies, but it's the marketplaces that aggregate attention and that hold the trust. These are the new department stores for D2C, and this is a big shift we're seeing in the world, and we see it in the numbers. 71% of UK consumers prefer it this way, and 53% are more likely to buy this way. They want this middle person. They want the marketplace to be there. It helps with discovery, and this is being a little bit less direct in D2C. Counterintuitive thing, but very, very interesting to see it emerge in our data.
Fascinating that we're recreating the department store from the high street, but now virtually. Well, look, you've given me an idea. You've mentioned quite a few D2C brands. So here's what I think we're going to do. We're going to have a poll, and we're going to use your recommendations as a shortlist. So I want all of our listeners to vote for their favorite D2C brand. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, overall as a brand, and the majority of our listeners are marketers. So as a marketer, which D2C brand do you really respect. And Jeremy, you gave us a great shortlist. And don't forget, the ones to vote for are Bloomin' Wild, Gymshark, Birchbox, and Brewdog. There's the shortlist. Let's find out who our listeners think is the best D2C brand. And I'll be honest, maybe it will get somebody from that D2C brand to come on the podcast afterwards. You never know. The link to the vote will be in the podcast notes, and we'll certainly amplify it on LinkedIn as well. So thank you for the inspiration, Jeremy.
A pleasure. Always exciting to meet new D2C brands. And it's always fun to be data-driven in how we assess the winners and losers and bring them into the networks.
Yeah. What's coming next, and kind of who should we watch out for?
Yeah, I'll look mainly to the US here, because that still is the genesis of many of the great D2C trends and ideas. And I'll take out the marketplaces. I think marketplaces almost becomes a D2C category unto itself. The new online department store are the marketplaces. And I think that's a separate thing now. Let's bring it back down to individual brands and propositions. So I'll pick out a few favorites. I love this new self-managed fertility trend. So there's Avia, that's female fertility, and Legacy, male fertility. Both brilliant US D2C companies. Avia monitor hormonal cycles and make recommendations for all sorts of aspects of women's health. Legacy help men to measure their own sperm health, and also to help you do family planning based on measuring your own sperm health at home, in your own time, under your own conditions, without any external parental medical attention. Quite awkward topics, but D2C makes it something that you control yourself and gives you huge advantages, particularly when you add large data sets. I also love stuff like Bite toothpaste, little pills of the toothpaste. We're forced to choose very specific brands of big retailers in plastic tubes, And I think that time has passed now. Now you can buy a little jar of toothpaste pills and you crunch them up in your mouth and you can choose from a whole bunch of flavors. Soap bottle make personal care products out of recycled soap. The packaging is made out of soap. Couple of others. I think my favorite is called Judy. They make emergency kits, three different sizes. One is called the Safe. It's like a big war chest full of, you know, just keep my family safe. There's a bum bag version and there's kind of a backpack version. I just love it because it's a great example of job to be done theory. The job to be done is healthcare in my house is taken care of. I buy a safe, $280. It sits in a corner. It's big and orange. It's got the word Judy on it. And whatever happens in my household or in my car, we're covered. Huge tick on safety. And Judy just gives you that in a box that they put in your house or a bum bag you can wear on your trek. I absolutely love that because going back to original flavor marketing, the job to be done is feel safe, and that's what they're selling. A couple of others I really like. Kualana make plant-based tuna that you can put into sushi. Raised Real, they make baby food, but it's actual real food. They just put it together and deliver it to you. Last couple, I really like Glyph, which is a molecular spirits brand. So they make things that taste like they've been barrel-aged for 21 years, but actually was just made overnight last night in San Francisco, and that's how they market it. So it's like fake age synthetic whiskey and spirits. Love that. And then the last one is Tushy, which is a transformational bidet kit for your bathroom. And you can choose from all sorts of features and give yourself the craziest Japanese style bathroom bidet features. And I don't know why people buy this, but apparently it's incredibly popular and they're absolutely crushing it. There's lots of people doing interesting things, but the themes in there are taking away awkwardity from things like fertility, adding sustainability to things like sushi and food, adding customization and choice where you never had choice before, like toothpaste, jobs to be done, the simplest form of marketing, make my family safe, buy it from Judy, buy a big safe box, has everything you need. And then crazy new stuff, and then just making it easy to try. Molecular spirits, have a go. Imagine the order a miniature for free if you refer 10 friends on that. I would be doing that right now. I'd probably sign you both up on the spot. And Tushy, weird thing, never thought about that before. Thought it was just in Japan. I can have that in my house. Why not order four? Interesting. Put that all together. I think those are the leading edge of D2C, but it's more the traits that are interesting things to copy, not the business model, but the traits that make them distinctive. I think that's the fun part to learn more about.
You know, I can imagine, as you said right at the start, kind of people looking for ways to start their business. It's like, what problem can I solve? You know, that kind of when you come up with it, it's like, oh yeah, why wasn't that around before?
Yeah.
sounds simple, doesn't it?
And there's a few in the UK. So let's pick out Beauty Pie. It's a membership beauty platform. You can save up to 80% on very, very premium beauty products. It helps you discover new products, a bit like Birchbox, but then it gives you these huge savings on top. And then they have this wonderful dynamic called Pie Days. So you can save 80% on your beauty products that you buy through Beauty Pie, but your spending rate is limited in a month. You can only buy so much stuff at this heavy discount rate, except on Pie Days, where you can go nuts and buy everything you want to, which is probably for you and a few friends, which is probably for you plus a little special gift for yourself, which is probably for you, and it justifies your membership fee just that little bit more. And you probably discover a few more products and trends because of it. Like, very clever dynamic they've got going on there, but it comes from an authentic place. They exist for discovery. They exist to give you cost savings. And on Pie Days, they just take off the cap and say, go wild. And people do. I love that. Really, really nice model. And there are a couple of others in the UK. You mentioned Oddbox, making it sustainable and convenient to buy food that would otherwise go to waste. That's alchemy, turning waste into gold and making a brilliant company around it. Motley, D2C marketplace for new jewelry designers. Again, it's that marketplace model, building a venue for new designers to go and letting the public choose how to pull through more demand, but it's the marketplace that aggregates the demand. New online department store just for jewelry on consumers' terms. And all of these things are built from knowing consumer preferences best, and that's why we're here. That's why we love these so much. it's interesting that so many brands can exist. So D2C makes the cost of creating a new product line, the cost of launching a new brand, the cost of offering something new and new channels to new people, it makes that cost lower than ever before. The barriers to entry are lowered by D2C, which means that we have this huge explosion of different brands, different propositions, and different selling styles. What's interesting is the infrastructure behind the scene, kind of the AWS for SaaS businesses. There's an equivalent for D2C businesses. It is supply chain. It is CRM and payments management. It's personalization. It's online marketing stack technologies. There's kind of a bit like there's a stack for software companies. There is also now a much larger stack for D2C companies. People that you have to choose to partner with, people, business model construction choices you have to make. And out of this come all sorts of interesting combinations. And it's a bit like evolution in biology. Everything can exist through chance mutations and occupying different ecological niches. And in the world of D2C, that's new consumer demands and things that are changing. But it's become far easier to create new life and to then evolve faster than ever. And that's why we've seen this huge explosion in D2C. There's a lot of success and failure, but the cost of failure is low and the rewards for success is high. And I think this trend is therefore here to stay.
So Jeremy, kind of, I guess a final question on this topic. So think about those that are right at the start of their journey, you know, either thinking to or about to start up, kind of that's the probably the scariest part. What would be your advice to those that are thinking about it or about to start?
We work with a lot of D2C companies. Most of the companies I've mentioned today are, in fact, Attest clients. And I think it leads me to think of two things as advice for people starting out on the D2C journey. One is authenticity. Got to pick a product that has a personal connection to you, something that means something to you. You will have to tell the story about why your brand exists, why you are uniquely positioned to do it, and why you have a view of the market that no one else does. You will have to tell that story thousands of times, maybe 1,000 times in a week. All of these D2C trends and all of the different infrastructure pieces and ingredients are here to help you work in your favor. But the one thing you can't miss is the authentic link to your personal connection and an authentic link to your consumer base. The second thing is there's these huge trade-offs in D2C. Do you do your own fulfillment? Who do you partner with? Do you offer free delivery? Is it paid? Do you offer free returns? Is it paid? That's just on delivery and infrastructure and packaging and returns. Are you a sustainable brand? Are you a B Corp? Do you donate to charity like many D2C companies do, or do you not? Who will you lose if you do or don't? The construction of these choices, particularly in the early days, is really, really important. There's a whole stack of providers that can work with you. There's a whole different set of ways you can build your D2C business. But some of them are really, really hard to reverse. And Aaron Gelbart at Bloom and Wild says it really well. You have to pick one or two things to be really, really good at. And you probably have to get those right and stick with them all the way through. And certain things like partners or business models or marketing machines or brand values and sustainability choices, those ones become very irreversible very quickly. And if you therefore pick something that's authentic, that's a story you're happy to tell 1,000 times, and you make congruent choices with how you set up your business, that's the road to success. Then all these trends that we've been talking about work in your favor. And if you get these things wrong, where you pick something where you don't have a personal connection, you don't have a unique advantage, and you make business model choices that then you need to change later, that's when you start tearing down your D2C business. And that's when it starts to be fighting against, you know, you're fighting uphill. And that's when these trends are diminished for you. So play to the trends, choose authentic, and choose wisely about how you construct your business, because then all of this opportunity is unlocked.
You know that we're predominantly about marketing, and there's a question we ask everybody who passes through our, dare I say them, hallowed halls, which is about your favourite ad, Jeremy. So, and often it reveals an awful lot about the person, so no pressure. What is your favourite telly ad, Jeremy? And because we're the audio medium, do your very best to describe it to our listener.
Oh, do I have to sing?
Well, it's obviously got music already. Okay, so it's a musical one, is it? Yeah, okay.
If you fancy it, Jeremy, yeah, please.
My favourite all time is the Carlton Draft. It's a big ad of 20... I think it was 2005, 16 plus years ago now. What happens is it in it is there's this amazing snap open where there's a guy in a coloured robe in the middle of the outback in Australia, and there's this huge classical music orchestral opening, and it immediately grabs your attention. And then there's people running in coloured gowns across a field, just singing in chorus, "It's a big ad. Very big ad. It's a big ad. We're in it." It's a big man. 4,000 drops. It's just so freaking good. I love it because it has this snap open. It grabs your attention immediately. You've probably never seen anything like it before, unless you saw that British Airways advert in the late 80s, which had a similar theme, and that they probably stole. Epic scale, epic budget, epic soundtrack, epic volume of people. It's very clear that it's an expensive ad. And then they break the fourth wall by telling you, it's a big ad. We're in it. We're, you know, guys like you trying to drink a beer, and we make this giant guy drinking a beer. That's it. You're welcome. And we really, they literally say the lyrics, "We hope this ad sells a lot of beer because it was really expensive to make." And that's just, you know, comes back to authenticity and realness.
Okay, well, that takes us to the end of the show, Jeremy. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very interesting listen. For sharing all your knowledge, insight, and experience. It's been fascinating. So before you go, kind of how can people access this insight you've been referring to, the D2C Digest?
We publish the D2C Digest on our website. It includes all sorts of interesting things, consumer trends from real data, live from the field. These things we're talking about, we're exposing live data directly from consumers that answer all these questions about how to unlock D2C and how to make it real. We also include a bunch of stories, leading businesses, advice from D2C leaders. We include the CEO of Bloom & Wild, Aaron Gelbard, Beauty Pie we spoke about, Dry Soda in the US, and a whole bunch of others. And it's just fun to, A, use real data to inform these big trends and learn more about what consumers think, because that's the ultimate driver of success in D2C and in marketing. And then second, to learn from people who really know what they're doing, people who've made the right choices, people who've succeeded, but also hear about things that they've tried and failed. That's often the most fun thing. We'll put a link to the report in the episode description, and you can find it on our Attest website. That's askattest.com, on our LinkedIn page, on our blog, all sorts of different ways. And we love as many people as possible to read it because it's full of exciting things.
And please vote for the poll. Just a reminder of what those brands are that Jeremy very kindly shortlisted for us: Bloom & Wild, Gymshark, Birchbox, and BrewDog.
Exactly. It's the first time we've tried a poll, so let's make sure it's not a failure, listeners. Brilliant. All right. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much. All the best, and we'll speak to you soon, I'm sure. So goodbye.
Real pleasure to chat. Bye.
Bye-bye.